It's here and now. In a moment, the congressional hearing you may not have heard about, name-calling, walkouts, and a serious topic, extraordinary rendition. But first, the Commerce Department reports today that new home sales tick up a notch last month, but not as much as economists hoped for. That combined with the news yesterday that existing home sales fell last month in the biggest decline in 18 years is putting homeowners and potential buyers on edge. There is some good economic news today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 13,000 for the first time ever in the first half hour of trading on Wall Street this morning. Well, joining us to make sense of the numbers is Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody'sEconomy.com. Mark, let's start with housing. New home sales went up just 2.6% in March. Existing home sales fell 8.4%. How bad is this housing slump?
It's bad. The housing correction is in full swing. It's been ongoing for almost 2 years, and we're still seeing sales decline, pricing is weak, less construction, we're losing jobs in the construction trades. It's still the weakest part of our economy.
Yeah, when we say that new home sales didn't go up as much as hoped, I'm imagining that that will trickle down to affect, you know, the sale of lumber and nails. How does it hurt the economy when existing homes continue not to sell? Boy, the existing home sales falling 8.4%. So remind us how that hurts the economy.
Well, obviously, it hurts the people involved in those transactions, the realtors, the brokers, the appraisers, the people in mortgage finance. They don't get as much business, and their jobs are affected. And as prices weaken for housing, that affects all of us because it means we're less wealthy, and as a result, that affects our willingness and ability to go out and spend.
Right, and the willingness of banks to make loans.
Yeah, exactly, and that's been the most significant recent problem. Mortgage lenders are now suffering with credit problems. The delinquencies, foreclosures are rising. And as a result, they're tightening their standards, and that means that people won't be able to get credit to go out and buy homes.
So how do we reconcile that with what would seem to be delirium on Wall Street? You know, the Dow passed 13,000 this morning. We remember in the past 2 months there have been big plunges in the stock market. So what's that all about?
Well, the housing market's the weakest part of the economy. Other businesses are doing quite well. Corporate profits are at record highs. Interest rates are low, and, of course, that's all very good for stocks. And most importantly, there's a lot of mergers and acquisitions, leverage buyouts, and that's putting a lot of money into the stock market and driving those prices up.
What does that do in the long term, though? I mean, let's say, you know, leverage buyouts and mergers, a lot of people lose jobs. It might be, you know, look really good for the bottom line initially, but does that continue to play out that way?
Yeah, in general, I think what we're doing here is reshuffling the economy's resources from one place to the other, hopefully from less productive places to more productive places so that, you know, ultimately we have a bigger, better, stronger economy. So I think in general it's a good thing. But you're right, it's not always good for everyone involved. A lot of people at these companies lose jobs and income as a result of these transitions.
I want to look at one number. The Commerce Department says that orders for durable goods such as airplanes rose 3.4% in March. That's the fastest in 3 months. Is that because airplanes are getting old and a lot of new ones are being ordered?
Well, that's part of it. It's also that traffic is up. People are out traveling again, lots of tourists, the business travel is up. And the planes are really quite full.
Well, just to try to get, again, another big picture snapshot here, we read in some of the economy stories today that some analysts are concerned that the economy is slowing down too quickly. Your thoughts on that? Do you agree? And what does that mean?
Well, the economy is growing, but the rate of growth is slowing. It's slowing because of the problems primarily in the housing market. This is helpful in the sense that it reduces inflationary pressures and keeps interest rates low, and hopefully that's what we'll see. We'll see inflation moderate and the expansion will continue to move forward. I'm not overly concerned yet about the slowing in the economy. I think so far it's been therapeutic, and you can see that in the stock market with the gains in equity prices. This is the best indication yet that the economy is going to continue to do well and the expansion is going to remain intact.
Mm-hmm. And one last thought from you. Do you think the housing market will get worse?
Yeah, I think the problems in the housing market are going to intensify in large part because of the problems now in the mortgage market and the tightening in credit standards by lenders. So the housing market is the weakest part of the economy. It will remain so, and it will continue to weaken through the summer.
Oh, boy, hire that guy who makes balloon hats at your open house this weekend. Do something to get people to come and look at your house if it's going to get worse.
Yeah, I mean, for sellers, it's obviously pretty tough, and you're going to have to be a good negotiator and really work to move your home.
Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody'sEconomy.com. Mark, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Let's face it, congressional hearings are not usually riveting, but one characterized as revealing, even bizarre, was held last week. It was probably overlooked because of the expected coverage of the Virginia Tech shootings, and it was spellbinding because of the candor of the participants. The House hearing was called Extraordinary Rendition in U.S. Counterterrorism Policy, The Impact on Transatlantic Relations. Rendition is the practice of asking foreign allies to seize suspected terrorists abroad, then turn them over to U.S. officials who move them to secret prisons, military facilities such as Guantanamo, or foreign governments like Syria, where U.S. laws on torture don't apply. European parliamentarians invited to last week's hearings said rendition was illegal and harmed U.S.-European relations. U.S. lawmakers worried about the erosion of due process. Then Michael Scheuer testified. Now, you might remember, he's the former CIA officer in charge of the Bin Laden unit. He also devised the Al-Qaeda rendition program in 1995 under President Clinton. We want to begin by listening to a chunk of his testimony last week.
The rendition program has been the single most effective counterterrorism operation ever conducted by the United States government. Americans are safer today because of the program, but that degree of safety will ebb as the senators just mentioned slowly but surely destroy the program. If mistakes were made, I can only say that that's tough. But war is a tough and confusing business, and a well-supported chance to take action and protect Americans should always trump other considerations.
Considerations like whether it turns out the alleged terrorist who was seized and in some cases tortured in foreign prisons turned out to be innocent. Here's an exchange between Scheuer and Committee Chair William Delahunt, beginning with Scheuer.
No one really cares what happens to these people. Let me speak for myself.
Cares about what people?
I don't care what happens to the people who are targeted and rendered. We wouldn't be operating against them unless they were enemies of the United States and it was documented.
What about those that clearly, eventually were determined to be innocent?
Mistakes are made, sir.
It's just a mistake.
Yes, sir. They're not Americans. I really don't care.
Jerry Nadler, Democrat from New York, also asked Scheuer if the U.S. owed an apology to those who were ultimately cleared. But Scheuer said if someone was rendered, there must have been a good reason. No one was kidnapped. And Scheuer positioned lawmakers as being soft on terrorists. Here's Nadler's response.
Nobody here cares about a terrorist rotting in jail. But when you say they weren't kidnapped, what do you mean didn't happen?
I would assume that no U.S. government lawyer would allow us to kidnap anyone, sir.
Lawyers will say a lot of things. Doesn't make them right.
It's not my concern.
Republican Dana Rohrabacher of California had invited Scheuer to testify and stood by the rendition program, saying Europeans obsessing over due process would lead to more terror.
We are at war, and we've got to make sure that we do not let go 50 terrorists who will go out and plant a bomb in London and kill 20,000 people in order to protect that one person who we arrested accidentally because his name was the same.
At that comment, jaws dropped, and the audience, which included members of the anti-war group Code Pink, wearing orange Gitmo-style jumpsuits, gasped, to which Rohrabacher replied,
"Well, I hope it's your families. I hope it's your families that suffer the consequences."
And that wasn't the half of it. Jeff Stein was at last week's House hearing on the impact of rendition. He's national security editor for the Congressional Quarterly. He joins us with more. Jeff, just first of all, what was it like to be inside that room?
Well, it was kind of an unusual hearing because there was such stunned silence and groans and boos in reaction to what was being said very forcefully at the hearing in defense of the renditions program.
Let's go through all of this. The former CIA officer, as we said, is Michael Scheuer. He authored the Al-Qaeda rendition program. As you point out, there's irony in the fact that many on the left embraced him because of his book Imperial Hubris. Remind us about that.
The book really condemned the administration's attack on Iraq in the most forceful terms of which Michael Scheuer is being known now, condemning it as an avaricious, unprovoked attack on a country and disastrous for U.S. foreign policy. Michael Scheuer is very typical in some ways of a whistleblower personality, in my opinion, in which they think they're the smartest guy in the room and don't tolerate people getting in their way. I happen to like Mike a lot. He's very gregarious, interesting, thought-provoking person, whether you agree with his opinions or not.
Well, and he repeated at those hearings something he said in the book and was somewhat overlooked at the time, that he did think that FBI agent John O'Neill deserved to die at the World Trade Center. And this is one of the heated conversations. Remind us why. What was his spat with O'Neill, by the way?
John O'Neill was the leading FBI agent trying to get Osama bin Laden, and they clashed. So what you have is Mike Shore's sort of dismissive attitude towards O'Neill, which at the end of a long and tedious and emotional hearing morphed into the best thing he said that happened on, the only good thing that happened on 9/11 is that the World Trade Center building crushed John O'Neill, which just, you know, you could almost hear a mass intake of breaths at that moment. And actually, as I went up to talk to Mike Shore after his testimony, someone came up and suggested he shouldn't speak ill of the dead.
Well, he was quite outspoken at several times. I'm thinking of when the case of Maher Arar was brought up. Arar was a Canadian citizen suspected of terrorist ties. He was arrested in the U.S. at Kennedy Airport while on his way back to Canada from a trip. He was sent to his native Syria in 2002. What did Arar allege happened there in Syria?
He said he was tortured for over a year, and given the track record of the Syrians, what we know about Syrian intelligence, we can believe that claim. People probably don't know, by the way, that we work with Syrian intelligence when there are areas of mutual interest, such as Al-Qaeda. Syria is no fan of Al-Qaeda either.
Well, the Canadians did an investigation, determined that they had made a mistake in Arar's case. They, in fact, awarded him over $10 million and gave him an apology. The U.S. has not apologized, and as we heard, Michael Shore said we shouldn't. But further, Michael Shore said he was the wrong guy to even be talking to. He made an interesting distinction about the CIA.
Well, I think he reflects a pretty common view in the intelligence community that the CIA shouldn't be taking all the rap for the rendition programs from critics of the renditions program, that these decisions are made in the White House. They are reviewed by top Justice Department officials and lawyers at the CIA. And the operative's job, what Mike Shore was trying to say, is our job is to go out and get these people off the street. It's your job in Congress and in the administration to clean up afterwards, as he put it, to make the legal niceties, to justify it in some way. And he was trying to say, through very provocative language, look, this is what you told us to do. This is what we're paid to do. We're paid to go out and snatch people, to get people off the street before they kill us, kill you. And so don't point the finger at the CIA. Point it elsewhere.
Jeff Stein, National Security Editor for Congressional Quarterly, on last week's extraordinary House hearings on extraordinary renditions and their impact on U.S. foreign relations. Take a quick break and come back with much more Here and Now. It's Here and Now. I'm back with more from Jeff Stein, National Security Editor for Congressional Quarterly. He was at last week's House hearings on the impact of renditions on the view of the U.S. from abroad. As we said, the U.S. uses the practice of rendition to have foreign governments seize suspected terrorists for the U.S. U.S. officials then transport them either to military prisons like Gitmo or hand them over to foreign governments. And Jeff, we were talking about Michael Shore, the CIA operative speaking at the hearing, former CIA agent. You know, he was saying sort of, what do you want from me? He also spoke of how the EU has a policy of not deporting wanted terrorists to countries that have the death penalty, which, of course, includes the U.S. So Michael saying, in effect, rendition is the only way to get these terrorists when they are on foreign soil.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it should be noted that the relevant officials in all these European countries have known about renditions and cooperated with them, had their intelligence services cooperate with them for a long, long time.
Well, in fact, he spoke to that as well. Some of the European delegates who were there were saying, for instance, the British parliamentarian saying, as legislators, we're excluded from knowing what's happening on our own soil. But Michael Shore said, seemed to say, the host government always knew that renditions were happening, that there was some hypocrisy there.
I think that that's right. I think these governments did know. Now, if the parliamentarians didn't know, that's not the fault of the United States. That's an internal issue in the UK, France, Germany, the Western European democracies, you might say. And it's no business of the United States. The United States' job is to defend itself. The CIA is the tip of the spear, as it were. Its job is to go out and get these people and do. And the whole mentality of the CIA, I can say, having worked with CIA a long, long time ago in Vietnam during my army stint, their mentality is go get the guys. Let somebody else, let the wonks worry about the internal politics of the governments who are cooperating with us. So there is some hypocrisy here. What changed is that the programs. Secret renditions and secret prisons alleged to be scattered around European countries, mostly in Eastern Europe. When they were exposed, this put politicians in a very, very difficult position because of the war in Iraq and the dramatic unpopularity of the United States as a result of the invasion of Iraq. So the politicians are in a bad position, and they really, for their survival, they have to condemn the United States in these secret detentions and renditions, whereas previously they were collaborating in them.
What is the status of this now? I mean, is it still ongoing as much as it was, let's say, maybe a couple years ago?
Well, because these are clandestine flights, we can't be sure exactly what's happened. But the EU Parliament has passed a resolution condemning the flights, but that's a political point. I don't know that the United States has decided to stop the war against al-Qaeda, and this is the primary focus of the war against al-Qaeda, is the renditions. Go get them. Bring them back.
I just want to ask you a couple of questions, Jeff Stein, again, given that you were at these hearings. Michael Scheuer said that he didn't feel that people who were wrongly detained and suspected to be terrorists should be apologized to. But Republican Dana Rohrabacher seemed to disagree. He said, you know, maybe President Bush should apologize for, you know, these mistakes and put this all behind us. Then he said, but Bush has a personality problem. Another interesting note in the hearing. What did he mean?
First of all, I have to say that Dana Rohrabacher is not one for apologizing much. I think he was playing to the crowd a little bit and saying, well, maybe the president should apologize. It would help put this issue behind us. And then just as with so many spontaneous things that happened during these hearings, he sort of mused aloud about the president's personality problem and that he wasn't a guy who was going to apologize for anything. And that's about as far as Rohrabacher took it. But it was an interesting moment of this very conservative, hawkish, conservative Republican talking about the president's personality problem, and which kept him from maybe being more effective in defense of the rendition.
At another point, Anne Wright, who was a member of Code Pink, and as other members of this anti-war group, they were dressed in orange Gitmo jumpsuits during the hearing. She stormed out because of a comment from Rohrabacher. She's apparently been a longtime diplomat. In fact, reopened the U.S. consulate in Kabul after the Taliban was ousted, then quit when the war in Iraq began. What did she say about all of this?
Well, she said it was disgraceful that U.S. officials and a congressman were talking so bluntly about these renditions as if no one was due an apology.
By the way, those who were for renditions seemed to say there was undue concern with due process. Many of the Democrats on the panel said that we have to be concerned with due process. But did you get the sense that lawmakers really wanted to see renditions stopped?
No. You know, I'm venturing into my own opinion here. I think that, you know, these things, the renditions program has gotten caught up in politics, which is not to say that the Democrats on the committee who are criticizing it, as well as a Republican, by the way, don't feel very deeply about protecting the civil rights of these al-Qaeda suspects. And I think it's a very, very serious issue, and it points to kind of a conundrum in the renditions policy. I mean, their job is to go out and get them, and if they break a few glasses along the way, well, so be it. We're going to make mistakes, and war is not clean. So I think that the concern is well based, but there's also an interest in embarrassing the administration, putting the administration on the defensive. That's clear.
Well, and it also occurs that, and I don't know if anyone brought it up, that the policy of rendition was instituted before so many American troops were in harm's way and potential targets for capture.
That's right. The policy of rendition began in the Reagan administration with a few snatches of Palestinian terrorists, and it's continued on for a long, long time.
Jeff Stein, National Security Editor for Congressional Quarterly, about last week's hearings on the impact of rendition on world public opinion about the U.S. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll continue to follow that story. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the Democratic presidential candidates gather in South Carolina for a debate. How will Barack Obama play in a state where a majority of registered Democrats are African American? That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, Russia's view, the Russian Walter Cronkite on the death of Boris Yeltsin. That's still ahead. Back after the news, Here and Now. Support from It's Here and Now. Russia said farewell today to former President Boris Yeltsin, the first freely elected Russian president. The last leader under the Soviet regime, Mikhail Gorbachev, attended Yeltsin's funeral at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. Current Russian President Vladimir Putin also joined former American presidents Bill Clinton and George Bush for that service. Yeltsin was laid to rest in a local cemetery above a bend in the Moscow River, where artists such as Anton Chekhov and Sergei Prokofiev are buried, far from the tombs of communist leaders such as Lenin, who are buried in Red Square. Well, to remember Boris Yeltsin, we're joined by journalist Evgeny Kisilov. He's been with us before. He hosts a weekly current affairs program on the Echo of Moscow, the leading radio station in Moscow. Evgeny, we talked on this program Monday about how Yeltsin is credited around the world for bringing down the Soviet Union, but also blamed by some of his countrymen for destroying a superpower. What are you feeling on the street? Is that it?
Yes, that's exactly what I am feeling, unfortunately, from the reaction of the people in the street. No matter what is my personal attitude toward Mr. Yeltsin's figure, and I think that he was a great man who contributed to the cause of freedom in Russia in no less manner than Mr. Gorbachev, who is much more revered in the West, for example. Most of the Russians still hate Yeltsin.
What about you? What was it like to interview Yeltsin?
It was a regular thing. You send the questions in advance. His speech writers prepare the answers. Then you have a right to ask a couple of follow-up questions. It was never an interview where you are allowed to freely communicate with the leader. But, well, compared with the red tape that I had to go through when I was interviewing Bill Clinton, because White House officials, they just subjected me to a string of tortures before we really went on tape.
Well, we understand Yeltsin had, well, actually, there was a word that he used. I'm not sure if I'm reading your writing, but he had a colorful phrase, many colorful phrases that he introduced to Russians, including squiggles.
He was not as eloquent as Mr. Putin is, and he was very nervous before the start of the interview. Once he began to improvise, actually, because he didn't like the text of his answers, the draft of his answers that was prepared for him. You know, he started to follow those lines, and then with a lot of irritation, he threw those pieces of paper, sheets of paper away, saying, well, that won't do. I don't like this. This is rubbish. And started to improvise and was very good at that. And by the way, that was in March 1996, and that was a very important interview because we were told beforehand that during the interview, he would announce that he is changing his policy in Chechnya and he is ready for negotiations with the rebel leaders. And that was a big compromise and a conciliatory step towards the public sentiment that was at the moment running very high against the war.
How did he use the phrase squiggles? Or did he say squiggles, or was it something he did?
He was struggling through a very he started to talk about something, and so he was trying to complete the sentence, and in the long run, it was nobody understood what he meant. So,
do you think that Boris Yeltsin's failures to follow through with some of the reforms that he pushed and to make them work economically for the country, do you think his failures in that arena explain Vladimir Putin's ability to chip away at reforms and his rise and his popularity?
Well, to a certain extent, yes, of course. In this country, people are ready to sell a lot of their personal freedom for a little bit of security and prosperity. They say that, unfortunately, I understand that there is an important percentage of Russian people, if we can call them people or citizens, because I don't think they deserve the name of citizens. But, you know, I think it was Benjamin Franklin who once said that those who are ready to compromise on their freedoms in order to gain more safety, they deserve no freedom, no safety.
Evgeny, you've already said that you believe that Yeltsin will have a mixed legacy, at least now. How do you think history will write about him?
I think he's a great statement. I think that Yeltsin will be considered one of the greatest champions of freedom and reform in the whole history of Russia. And his name will be written in golden letters along with the names of Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Alexander the Second, Khrushchev, and Gorbachev.
Evgeny Kisilov, he hosts a public affairs program on the Echo of Moscow, the city's leading radio station. Evgeny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, astronomers are in a tizzy today. For the first time, an Earth-like planet has been discovered outside our solar system. 581 c was found by a consortium of European astronomers 20.5 light-years from Earth, orbiting a parent star called Gliese 581 in what's called the Goldilocks zone, a narrow orbit in which temperatures are not too hot, not too cold, just right for water and therefore life to exist. Kelly Beattie is planetary specialist for Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly, how exciting is this?
Well, I think it's pretty exciting if you take into consideration that astronomers have been searching for other planets for decades now. There's more than 200 of them logged around other stars. This is the first one, the only one that they can point to that's about the size of Earth and is circling a star that's anything like our sun.
Well, tell us what we know, because we hear five times heavier than Earth.
Well, that's right. That makes it a kind of super-Earth with maybe about half again the diameter of our own planet and maybe twice the gravity. You could walk around, but it would be a sluggish day.
You'd be very heavy, very fat on this planet.
You wouldn't have a good hair day.
Right.
But the point is that we really don't know that much about this planet yet. We don't know, for example, if it has an atmosphere, because it hasn't been actually seen. We only know it's there because of the wobble that its gravity induces in its parent star.
I love that. It's sort of sending off something that's making other things wobble. Well, you know that scientists are saying a significant step in the search for life outside our solar system. Some even saying, this is it. You know, this is it. Well, you know, you seem a little more tempered when we've talked to you.
I am, because if you take, for example, the planet Venus, which is also within the habitable zone of our sun, it's got a surface temperature of nearly 1,000 degrees. As I said, we really don't know anything about the physical characteristics. It looks good on paper, but until we actually get some studies and maybe what astronomers call a spectrum of the planet itself, we won't be able to really say anything definitive.
Well, I'm wondering, too, Kelly, if scientists who want to, you know, the funds to look further should get a better name. 581C, you know, it's hard to get people behind that.
You know, it's from a catalog of this Gliese catalog is of stars that are really close to the Earth, and this is one of them. So
okay,
That's where we should look.
Kelly Beattie, planetary specialist for Sky and Telescope magazine, looking up at a newly discovered planet. Kelly, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now. Was it something she said? Today, Rosie O'Donnell and ABC announced that she will leave The View in June. Rosie, the outspoken co-host of the morning talk show, said her needs could not be met in contract negotiations, and ABC Network President Brian Franz agreed. But right-wing groups and talk show hosts have targeted O'Donnell for her comments. And after Don Imus was fired by CBS earlier this month, many called for Rosie's firing as well. The lobbying group Focus on the Family announced that it was preparing to contact advertisers of The View as part of a campaign against O'Donnell. So for more on all of this, we turn to Gail Shister, columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. So, Gail, you know, what do you think? You know, Rosie has had a bout of name-calling with Donald Trump, with Bill O'Reilly. Is that a part of this?
A part of her decision or part of ABC's decision?
Yeah, whose decision do you think it was?
I think it probably was mutual. I think it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, Rosie has been great for ratings for The View. Their numbers were up 15% in the February sweeps, and so that's money in the bank for ABC. But on the other hand, she's a wild card, and you never know who's ego she's mm-hmm. going to step on or who she's going to make angry, and sometimes she just goes off. She doesn't have any kind of filter, which in one way makes the show fun to watch and great television, but it makes ABC executives very antsy.
Right. Well, and the reason that we dip our toe in this is that, as you well know, there is a 9/11 movement, including some college professors, people claiming that there's more to the story behind 9/11 than has been reported. Now, people making a controversial movie about this, the 9/11 Truth Committee, claim that Rosie has joined their group. We can't find any comment from her. But she hints at this controversy during an exchange with co-host Elizabeth Hasselbeck, in which she says the World Trade Center building number 7 could not have come down without explosives. Let's listen.
Do you believe in a conspiracy in terms of the attack of 9/11?
No, but I do believe that it is the first time in history that fire has ever melted steel. I do believe that it defies physics for the World Trade Center Tower 7, Building mm-hmm. 7, which collapsed in on itself. It is impossible for a building to fall the way it fell without explosives being involved. World Trade Center 7. World Trade 1 and 2 got hit by planes. 7, miraculously, the first time in history, steel was melted by fire. It is physically impossible.
And who do you think is responsible for that?
I have no idea. But to say that we don't know that it imploded and it was an implosion and a demolition is beyond ignorant. Look at the films. Get a physics expert here from Yale, from Harvard. Pick the school. It defies reason.
Let's get one. Because that
I would do it.
Well, Gail Shister, as you know, that just caused an uproar in a lot of right-wing talk radio. Again, are you hearing anything that might connect those comments to today's news?
I think you could, without sounding too much like Oliver Stone, I think you could make the quantum leap that it's one thing to take shots at Donald Trump, it's another thing to start putting out conspiracy theories about 9/11. I think she did offend a lot of people about the 9/11 when she came out with that. I know that my first reaction was, when did Rosie get a degree in structural engineering? I just get very nervous when people who are not experts come out with definitive statements. When she said, it is impossible for fire to melt steel, I just had, which made me really anxious because, as far as I know, she doesn't have a degree in structural engineering. So I think that didn't help things with ABC because you can make a lot of defenses for putting other people's noses out of joint. But when you get anywhere near 9/11, you're really hitting a sensitive nerve.
Well, and of course, her supporters would say, and the people who ask us constantly to cover this story more would say, all she's saying is, why can't we ask these questions? I just want to touch before we go, Gail, on a point that some are already making, that in fact none of these comments may have anything to do with this. I'm looking at broadcasting and cable, and they're writing today that in fact she may have been angling for her own show, and they were unable to give her that, and she may get it somewhere else on cable, for instance, and this may be what she's looking for.
That is possible, because one of the things that happened when she went on The View is that it no longer became The View. It became The Rosie O'Donnell Show, or The View starring Rosie O'Donnell. It's very clear she's a serious alpha female, and she's not into sharing much airspace, and she did take over the show in a way that Meredith Vieira never did.
Right.
When Meredith was on and Barbara Walters was on, she deferred to Barbara.
Gail, we have to go, but thank you so much. Gail Shister of the Philadelphia Inquirer. More ahead, here and now. It's Here and Now. Why do Americans read so much about food? Well, food writer Molly O'Neill thinks she has the answer.
At the deepest level, I think we Americans read about food to remember how it feels to be hungry and to deserve a meal, to imagine being windswept and exhausted, shivering and lonely, to feel, as the early explorers did, racked by the appetite born of long odds and great hope. We read about food to feel the things that thoughts of food can fix, which is just about everything. Every meal, after all, is a new beginning.
Molly has collected over 250 years of food writing in one big volume. It's called American Food Writing, an Anthology with Classic Recipes. And former New York Times food writer Molly O'Neill joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hello.
And you write, what's distinctive about American food writing is how constant and close to the surface is its sense of moral struggle.
Yeah, yeah.
That is so deep. What do you mean by that?
We have so much ambivalence. We want to be democratic and we want everyone to be well fed and to have the same thing. And yet we use food to distinguish ourselves from each other, you know, different classes, different races, different geographies. So as much as we use food to distinguish, we use it as an expression of our democracy,
right,
and our great bountifulness as a nation.
Well, and we distinguish in different ways at different times. You point out, for instance, in Mary McCarthy's The Group, there's that scene where a character tells another about the new iceberg lettuce.
Yes.
You know, you'll never need that old Boston lettuce anymore. Yes. Because iceberg lettuce was what? It was,
well, it was just being invented. And it's so crisp, it's so wonderful, it'll stay forever in your refrigerator. You don't need that silly old Boston lettuce from your mother's garden.
Right.
And
right.
Now, of course, we all want the silly old Boston lettuce.
Right. So our sense of what food represents as far as class issues changes
constantly
over the years. I want you to read a little from your introduction about what food writing means to you.
Food keeps one in the present. The physical sensation of a flavor in the mouth is an antidote to the flavorlessness of our increasingly abstract and virtual world. A good piece of apple pie is not just about the apples or about the crust. It is instead about the collision of tensions, soft and firm, sweet and sour, salty and buttery. Likewise, a good piece of food writing is never just about the food. It is, among other things, about place and time, desire and satiety, the longing for home, and the lure of the wider world. In a good piece of food writing, dozens of other tensions skittle just beneath the surface of these basic conflicts. The civilized competes with the wild. The idiosyncratic tugs at convention. Self-control campaigns to squelch self-indulgence. A meal, like the written account of it, is a declaration of self.
So what is the chowder in Herman Melville's Moby Dick?
Oh, isn't that a wonderful passage?
Yeah.
The two men are windswept, they're exhausted, and they get to their boarding house and they just can't wait to see the menu. And the menu is, you can have chowder.
Right. This is on Nantucket.
On Nantucket. The only question is it going to be a fish chowder or a clam chowder? And what Melville's doing in that passage is really talking about the joy and the comfort of settled life.
Yeah. Emily Dickinson's recipe for black cake is in your book. Yeah, she wrote it in a letter to someone.
Yes, she did. And one of the things that we see in her correspondence is, contrary to the notion of Emily Dickinson as sort of the Victorian lady of Amherst, she was fabulous. She was always telling her nieces, oh, go down to the cellar and try the blackberry wine, or don't go to church, stay home and cook, have something great to eat, really indulge yourself.
You include my absolute favorite. Can we just have a moment and pause after I say the name, M.F.K. Fisher? One of the great luminaries of food writing. She writes about oysters. Oysters is what?
Well, oysters as a metaphor for the whole world. The world is your oyster. Oyster as life, oyster as daring. Oyster is sex. Oyster is indulgence. Oyster is sensuality.
I mean, the richer you were at a certain time of our history, the more oysters you could have shipped to you from the farther away places for your turkey stuffing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Let's see, Mae Sarton, another one, writes about finding sukiyaki in a little corner of Hawaii post-World War II. It's one of those stories, you know, and I'm sure you've had these experiences where when you're traveling, there's a little sign on a door, and suddenly behind that door is something Marvelous.
That was such a wonderful story, though. When you imagine Mae Sarton, Hawaii was the wilds then. It was not a tourist destination. And she was traveling without a map and just happened into this place. It gave me a whole new view of Mae Sarton, but also a whole new view of Hawaii. And I think that's what a good piece of food writing does.
Right. There's humor, too. We want to point out you've got David Sedaris writing about dining out with a jacket on loan from the maitre d'. David writes, apparently he thought I'd feel more comfortable dressed to lead a high school marching band. There's Russell Baker's Franks and Beans. Now, this was written in response to Craig Claiborne's infamous article about his $4,000 dinner for two with 31 dishes. Claiborne had won it in a charity, but it still caused this uproar that he wrote about this, you know, expensive meal. And Russell Baker writes in response about his meal of beans and fried bologna a la Nutley Nouveau Jersey. with a 1975 Diet Pepsi and an accompanying drink of cold milk in a wide-brimmed jelly glass. You know, both those stories, Claiborne's and Baker's, sort of say something.
Yeah, it was a real gauntlet. There was a generation, our generation, coming of age, deeply steeped in the counterculture, deeply suspicious of conventional society. By the same token, we were foodies. All of us read Craig. And suddenly, here he was in Paris buying this intensely expensive, indulgent meal and writing about it. And we wanted to know about the meal, yet it made us feel very nervous. Americans don't spend money that way. Baker's response, I mean, Twain could not have done better. It turned it into kind of a circus. It expressed a little bit of a feeling that everyone had had. But I think it was part of the departure from the American honoring the French cuisine and feeling less than and opening the floodgates to an American cuisine. Okay, our cuisine is not beans and Franks, but what could it be?
Right. If we're not Claiborne with the $4,000 meal with things you can't pronounce and 31 dishes, and we're really not, you know, Franks and beans and milk out of the jelly glass anymore, what are we?
Well, we became Alice Waters. We became Chez Panisse. We became regional American cuisine. We became a nation obsessed with what it's going to eat and what it has eaten and what it would like to eat. Mm. But that was just the beginning moment. And one of the joys of editing a volume like this is that you get to see the progression of change.
By the way, Molly O'Neill, we've had you here before. You wrote your own memoir. What are you doing? What are you setting your sights on?
Well, I just finished this anthology for the Library of America, and I'm working now on a portrait of America told through its food. I'm traveling around the country and interviewing people and collecting recipes. So we're going to have to get your listeners to start sending in their favorite recipes.
Oh, should they? Just to send
Absolutely.
To you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
American, sort of like whatever that means to them.
Whatever that means. I have room for 1,000 recipes, and each one really has to tell the story of a place or a person or something that's very dear to a family.
All right. Well, if people want to do that, go to our website, here-now.org. In the meantime, Molly's been talking about the new anthology, American Food Writing, an anthology with classic recipes from the Library of America. Molly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I like to dance. I like to sing.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.